Hello and welcome to The Coiled Spring. I'm Matthew Petty, your host. Well, this is the second episode of this podcast, so I can only assume from that either you haven't heard the first one, or you heard the first one and you're back for more, which is a nice positive way to spin things. Either that, or you heard the first one, you weren't quite sure what you heard, so you're coming back to listen and see if you can figure out what the hell's going on. I've got another great show for you lined up. I've got a continuation of the interview from last time with Kristen McGorry, where we cover all sorts of things, including video games, which is something we've both got a lot to say about, the history and the nostalgia of them especially. And also I've got another fantastic guest lined up, although because I'm recording this before I know who it is, I can't really say much about them, apart from that they are really interesting people and you are going to definitely enjoy listening to them talk. So listen on and thanks for coming back.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
So Kristen, you're currently working for, EA.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Electronic Arts, it's in the game.
It is.
And EA Sports, actually.
EA Sports is, yeah.
That's yeah.
True. And, are you interested in video games?
No, I just kind of
You're supposed
into...
to say at that point, I'm glad you asked me that, Matthew.
Oh, am I?
Yes.
I'm glad you asked me that, Matthew, because, yes. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a huge sort of gamer, really. Mm. So much so that whenever they want to do like a profile of a girl gamer for sort of marketing purposes, they always come and ask me because they obviously don't know any other girl gamers. But so I kind of made video games my career, really turned it from a sort of a hobby into a career.
What exactly do you do? Are you a developer or...?
No, so, well, when I say I turned it into my career, I basically take other people's work and I sort of promote that. So I kind of work across with the community, really. So
And that's become a bigger thing in recent years,
of course. Yeah,
the social side of things. And in fact, am I right in saying that the part of EA that you work for focuses on the casual or social gaming side of things?
Yeah, so it is the more sort of casual gaming audience.
Which has exploded.
Yeah, it's huge. Well, I suppose the thing is that a lot of these people who are playing games on Facebook, they don't really consider themselves gamers.
No.
But they go onto Facebook and they kind of put whatever inane update that it is on.
Yeah.
I just had toast. It was great.
Sometimes, though, have you never had really good toast?
Sometimes
there's toast that's worth a status update.
That is true. But do you know my favourite type of status updates?
Yes.
Are status updates that beg. They're like the passive-aggressive status updates.
Oh, yeah.
Where people like go, it's happened again. Or, it's one of those days.
Yes.
And then you just get loads of people coming, it's like, yeah. I want to punch those people in the face.
That's cool. Mm. And if you could make that into a social gaming experience of... punching
How
annoying comments.
Would that be?
Yeah, that would be
It's
great.
A genius idea. We should it make is. It happen. Patent it
Painted
right
it.
Now.
You heard it here first. millionaires tomorrow. Well, of course, we have to be careful who we tell because Zynga might steal the idea.
Yeah, they might.
Ooh.
Oh.
Can we talk about
no.
that?
No.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, moving swiftly on. How did you get started in video games as a hobby?
So, my brother, when one Christmas, my brother, who got all the best toys, I asked my mum for a microscope. This is a little side story. One year I asked my mum for a microscope because I wanted to, like, cut things open and look at them underneath.
Of course, this is going back to the horror side of things. Yeah, torture porn and stuff.
Yeah. And she bought me a kaleidoscope. So,
and, of course, that goes back to the... Dario Argento.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, And then I think the following year I got a post office set, which is literally the worst present that you could ever get. In this, you essentially can set up your table and as if you're working in a post office.
Right.
Even the people who are actually paid to work in post offices do not want to be there.
Right.
So why would you give a child a post office set?
I'm trying to think. I mean, do you get a rack of leaflets?
Yeah, you try.
There's empty. I don't know.
Yeah. You try to sell people insurance or yeah. No, it was in the old fashioned days of the post office.
Okay. So it didn't have a thing that said cashier number one, please.
No, it didn't. Shame. No, this is when you used to queue for sort of an hour before.
And there'd
you
be some sort of
90-year-old retiring.
Yeah.
And they wonder why they close them all down, the local post offices.
Dear.
God, this is getting political now.
It is.
So, yeah, so that was the second. And my brother used to get the best presents ever. So he got sort of all the Star Wars figures and the Millennium Falcon. And one year he got...
Just to make you feel better, everyone knows a kid like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't me.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he was the kid that you basically would bring the best on the day that you had to bring in the last day of school.
Yeah.
You'd get one kid who like brought in the really cool present and then all the other kids would take great pleasure in smashing that present up.
Yes, yeah, well that's yeah.
Yeah, that was my brother.
That's cool.
Yeah. And he either would break things or he'd get bored of stuff. And so one year my mum bought him a Sinclair.
Sinclair what?
A Spectrum.
Now,
she bought him a Sinclair Spectrum.
Now, is this a 16K rubber keys? Or?
Yes, this was a 16K
so that's
rubber keys.
Oh, that's the first one then.
Yeah. Okay. So she bought him this and he proceeded to get it out of the box and sort of like, he was quite young at the time, he was a bit young for a computer really, and sort of like stare at it. And so my mum then basically told me to set it up and that was it really. So that was my first kind of experience. I'd obviously, you know, played like sort of video game machines and you know, who hasn't?
And like I remember going to the swimming pool in Bedford, Robinson Pool, and then going to the little cafe afterwards and buying a bag of those horrible things that were like Rice Krispies covered in coloured sugar.
I don't know. Rainbow
dust or horror.
Something. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nightmare fuel. No.
ACD fuel.
Something like that. Yes, exactly. And play Scramble. Because that was... Oh, no. They had Scramble in the cafe and they had Carnival, which was where you were like shooting the ducks going backwards and forwards in the lobby.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's a historical document of
what it was like.
Late 70s Bedford. Thank
you.
Yeah. But so you set up your brother's Spectrum and you would play, what, would you play Jetpack and things like that?
Yeah. And actually, this will show you what a complete and utter geek I was, but one of my favourite games was a game that I borrowed from the library.
Wow, that is geeky.
Yeah. So you could borrow games from the library, and this game was a stocks and shares game. And the idea of this game was that you bought stocks.
Yes.
And then the 12 hours, the kind of the trading would happen, and it would kind of happen on the computer. It was completely text-based.
Yes.
And then, you know, at the end of it, it would say, oh, this shares went up, these shares went down, are you going to sell, are you going to do this, are you going to do that? And, you know, as a sort of a 11-year-old child, I was really excited by the prospect of, you know, making virtual money on shares.
Making virtual money, of course, leads you right into your current career, which is stealing people's real money
stealing
in a virtual way.
For virtual goods, yes.
Here, have a JPEG. That'll be a dollar, please.
Yeah.
Marvellous.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, what can I say? It's
content is king.
Yeah, and people digest content now in a very digital way.
That's
so,
very true.
Yeah, you don't. People don't really own physical things anymore, do they? You know, you download things from Netflix, you download things from iTunes.
So you
have this sense of ownership, even though it doesn't exist in anywhere other than the virtual world.
And in fact, it's gone further than that, I would say, that you don't even download it anymore from iTunes. You maybe just listen to it on Spotify.
Exactly.
Or Audio.
Yeah.
Or somewhere like that. No, I see what you mean. But, so you were playing on your Spectrum, and then you know, and as the years rolled by,
I just sort of always played video games, and you know, I suppose it came from I love games, I love board games, and when I was at school, I did this. We used to have this. We were a very progressive sort of school, and we used to have these things called day tens and week tens. So every week, 10 weeks, they would give you like a week to go off and do something, and you would like choose a module, and it would be something from like you could have like Japanese cookery week or hang gliding week.
Wow.
Or, yeah, and one week
progressive.
It was brilliant. The one week I chose to do D&D week.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, so I basically met this group of guys who then became my best friends all the way through school, and we played D&D for a week, and then that was it. We would meet every sort of night after school, and we would play sort of tabletop dungeons. Well, it was actually Bushido, but
Bushido. Okay.
Yeah.
I never really played D&D. I mean, me and a neighbour tried to get into it, but it was just the two of us, and it wasn't really enough.
Yeah, two isn't really enough.
And then I was invited to join a group at college, but no, because I don't like the spell of BO is a problem there.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting that all D&Ds are like that. It was just in these people in particular.
Yeah.
It was a very bad situation. And because it sounds like absolutely amazing fun. I mean, the whole imagination, and I read, you know, short stories about people who play these games, and Yeah, it's something I feel like I've missed out on, but I guess it's too late now.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, it's never too late. Coil
Spring. For this episode, I'm going to be reviewing Hostess cupcakes, and they come in a range of flavours, so this time I'm going to be looking at the orange flavour. They look pretty artificial, it has to be said. So what do we have here? Hostess cupcakes, frosted orange flavoured cake with creamy filling. And it says next to orange natural flavour, so there's something to be said for that. So let's have a look. Well, first thing you notice is that they come in a little cup, like a tray made of two cups, and that's made out of orange plastic, carrying on the orange motif in the design. And on the top of each of the cupcakes is a layer of frosting, and then there's the distinctive trademark squiggle of white frosting on top of that. So let's dig this out of a tray. Oh, again with the... Yeah, they've been squished again. I must keep my review cakes more secure because they do get squashed. But anyway, so this cake, it's a kind of a sticky sponge cake with the dry frosting on top. So let's first taste the frosting. Well, it's sugary, it's sweet, it's orangey flavoured. That's pretty good. Let's bite into the cake now. As I suspected, it's quite a dense, sticky, sugary cake, and then there's this creamed filling in the middle, which is, I think it's the same cream that we had in the ho-hos before. It tastes sweet, but not in a sugary way, more in a kind of a chemical way. And this ties into my theory that these cakes were byproducts of the American industrial military industrial complex in the 50s and 60s. You know, NASA, Lockheed, and all these companies, and they, you know, as a byproduct, they made Velcro and Hostess snack cakes. I think that's what's going on here. But overall, this is actually quite nice in a kind of grotesque way. I would consider possibly eating one of these again. You do get two. I'm eating one now. And I think Cassie said that she wanted to have the other one, so I will give that to her. But there you go. It's not bad. I'm looking forward to seeing what other flavours they've got. I think there's obviously a chocolate one, which is the original. And they come in various flavours, and we'll see. I'll try them all for you so that you don't have to. So I'm going to eat the rest of this, and I'll see you next time.
You're listening to The Coiled Spring.
So, I mean, I'm quite interested in video games myself, but only in a very casual way. And I've never, you know, for example, I've never had a console. Because,
interesting.
Well, yeah, because I'm basically a skinflint. And consoles are expensive, and the games are expensive, and I'm not that great at them. And I don't... Well, that's the other thing, you see. Not only am I a skinflint, I have very little staying power for actually achieving anything.
Right.
By the way, there will be no episode 2 of this podcast for this for these reasons. No, I'm joking. But so a console is expensive, and you got to stick with it to get your money's worth.
Mm.
So I never really got into that.
Yeah, you see, I suppose I took a very different approach because I've got every console.
Yeah, I gather there is a wall of consoles.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's kind of about the experience. So, I mean, obviously, being in the industry, you end up. You kind of kid yourself that the reason that you're buying the consoles is because you need to sort of stay abreast of each technology.
But the
reality is that what you end up having then is sort of like three things, two of which mostly gather dust, because you tend to kind of play on one rather than the other.
Well, especially now with these AAA games. And what does AAA stand for, by the way?
Well,
when they talk about AAA games being like the big...
Yeah, those
productions.
Yeah, so those will be your blockbuster sort of games.
But what does AAA actually mean?
I don't actually know what AAA means.
I'll have to ask someone about that.
Yeah, ask someone who's in video games marketing. Hang on.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where the AAA.
I mean, it's maybe
awesome,
just...
awesome.
Yeah, maybe.
No, I don't think it does.
But these AAA games, they're long. Hopefully you're playing them for a long time, especially when they're like RPG ones, which are supposed to be open-ended anyway.
Yeah, like stuff like Skyrim.
Exactly.
Yeah, I didn't even brush the surface of that, and I played for like 100 hours. It's ridiculous.
And you're not playing on other games in the meantime, and you become obsessed, or I've got to get home and finish Assassin's Creed or whatever.
Yeah.
See, I know the titles.
You can talk about it convincingly. Well done.
Thank you.
Well done, you. Yeah. But I think that's the interesting thing. But the thing is now is that obviously some of these games have such high production values.
Yes.
And they have sort of Hollywood script writers working on them, and voice actors.
Yes.
And think people like Simon Pegg and Stephen Fry were both in the most recent Fable.
Right, and who was it played some robot character in Portal 2?
I can't remember.
I think it was an old college colleague of yours.
Oh, it's not Mr.
Mr. Merchant.
Mr. Merchant. Mr.
Yeah.
Stephen Merchant.
Yes.
Was it really?
Yeah, he...
I haven't played Portal 2 yet, I've got it, but...
Like, it's one of these white, rounded robot things, and he's... I can't remember what he... I haven't played it. I haven't played the first one.
Yeah.
But I know he's in
it. But you know he's in it.
See, these little snippets, you see, that we're hanging the rest of the interview off. It's great. It's very effective. It's an effective technique.
Yeah. But I think it's really interesting as well, because, now what you're getting is you're getting kind of... almost interactive movies where you make the decisions and you own that character, which means that the blurring between the creative process, so you don't have that traditional very linear games anymore. You have these sort of sandbox games where you can make decisions, and I think that gives the consumer or the players much more of a sense of ownership around that individual content.
Ownership of the world or of their own experiences.
Exactly. Ownership of the world, ownership of their experiences, ownership of how they want the story to end or to progress. And so you get situations where you invest a lot of time in a character and it's becoming a bit like life. So if it doesn't go the way that you want it to go, you're somehow disappointed.
Absolutely.
But then you've got somebody to rail against, because obviously if your life doesn't go very well, if you believe in God, you've got God to kind of rail against. So then they rail against the developers and demand downloadable content.
Now, downloadable content. Now, talk about railing against the developers, and you've mentioned before about being a female gamer.
Mm.
There's a lot of talk at the moment about the sexism and misogyny that appears in games, and especially in games where you're playing online with loads of strangers. Have you encountered anything like that?
No, not really. I mean, obviously, games development is a very male sort of skewed thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting a lot better. But I think what you've got is very because of the nature of the games, so be they kind of shoot 'em ups or be they kind of huge space operas or, or you know, sword and sorcery epics, it's quite a black and white world, really. And it's a world where you're creating, you know, you're kind of creating, you're not really creating three-dimensional characters because you can't, you're creating archetypes. So obviously there is a lot of potential there for the guy to be always sort of incredibly muscled and slightly dumb, and the woman to be huge-breasted and wearing the kind of outfit. Yeah, that would really be impractical in a fighting situation.
Yeah, that's true, yes. But I think, I mean, what I've seen as well is games players reacting very badly to, well, to female players. And I think in one case there was a real backlash against a female developer. I think we're involved in... what's the one? Never mind. It'll come to me. Because the game didn't come out, or the sequel of the game didn't come out like they wanted, or some of the gameplay was changed, all the ire of the gameplaying community, or at least a segment of it, went on this one female producer who was kind of responsible for it, and it was really quite ugly. That sort of thing. Do you think that's, what's the word? Endemic? Is that the word?
I don't know. I don't think it's endemic. I think it's more symptomatic of the fact that you can hide behind anonymity now online. Yes. So if you, in the past, if you kind of went into a store and you bought something and then you didn't like it and you took it back, then you would have to go and have a real human interaction with someone, and it would be very unlikely that you would walk straight into the shop and go, this piece of complete and utter crap that you sold me, and it's all your fault, and you made it, and
you should die, and all
and
the,
you should die, and I, you know, I hope you get cancer and your head falls off.
But that's
the thing about the internet, is that firstly it gives you, like I said, this real sense of entitlement. If you spend a lot of time doing something and interacting with something, then you feel like you own a part of it.
Right.
And then it also makes it very, very easy for you to. I mean, you're very passionate about this because you and you find that in gaming a lot, is you have very, very passionate people, and if you mess with the thing that they love, that they feel that they own, is you know, that the ire that comes out about that,
and the ease of expressing that.
Yeah, exactly.
Forums and the chat box in the corner and so on. So, and I suppose that, you know, it has to be said, the demographic of gaming can impact that. So I suppose giving 13-year-old boys tools to express themselves instantly and anonymously, and in these ways is I mean, it's a good thing, I suppose, but it's going to be expected. Now, that is not to say, and I know that what some of the defence of this kind of sexism and misogyny that you get is that, well, that's just the nature of the game, and if you don't like it, get out the kitchen. Well, that's obviously horrible. But yes, it seems to be part of the, unfortunately, it's part of the landscape.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I actually read a really interesting article about, because it's not, I think it can happen to anybody. You know, you could be a sort of a 40-year-old housewife in sort of Maine and get involved in this kind of trolling but I read a really interesting article about sort of girls and when groups of girls get together on communities, and they start acting in a way that's very similar to when they start kind of dating for the first time when they're teenage girls.
Because
they will see any kind of commentary or any change to their environment as being like a rejection, and so they'll sort of build themselves up into this, why hasn't he phoned me, do you think he still likes me?
Yes.
This kind of insecurity, I suppose.
Well, insecurity combined with I am the centre of my world.
Yes, yeah.
And the fact of the matter is that he hasn't checked his messages yet or something like
I think it's different groups of people will can sometimes, you know, feed off each other, but that doesn't also mean that those societies and those communities don't level themselves out and police themselves as well.
Yeah.
Because you've got to remember as well that the people who are going on these things are, you know, how often do you go and say, well, that was really great, I thought you did that brilliantly?
Absolutely, yes. Yelp has more negative reviews than positive.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably not true, but yes, I know exactly what you mean. If you're angry about something, you're more likely to sit down and say, I'm going to write a letter to my MP.
Yeah.
Or about whatever, or to send a letter to the BBC, or to phone the BBC, or whatever. How do you phone the BBC? I've never really known about that. They always talk about the switchboards are melting. But
you just imagine that 1950s sort of thing.
Yeah, with like in Hong Kong Phooey at the beginning there. Yes. Hello there.
Yeah.
And here are the ingredients for Hostess Orange Cupcakes today, September 16th, 2012. Ingredients, sugar, water, enriched bleached wheat flour, reduced iron, B vitamins, niacin, thiamine, mononitrate, B1, riboflavin, B2, folic acid. Partially hydrogenated vegetable and or animal shortening, soybean, cottonseed and or canola oil, beef fat. Corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, whole eggs. Contains 2% or less of modified corn starch, soy lecithin, corn starch. Soybean oil, leavenings, sodium acid pyrophosphate, baking soda, corn starch, and monocalcium phosphate. Egg whites, non-fat milk, salt, whey. Natural and artificial flavour. Soy flour. Calcium carbonate, mono and diglycerides. Calcium sulfate, glucose. Orange oil, dextrose. Sorbic acid to retain freshness. Yellow 5 and 6 lakes. Guar gum. Cellulose gum. Sodium stearate. Polysorbate 60. Potassium sorbate. Titanium dioxide. Colour. Agar, locust bean gum, gelatin. Soy protein isolate, calcium and sodium caseinate, sodium phosphate. Yellow 5, red 4. Contains egg, milk, soy and wheat. And that concludes the ingredients for Hostess Orange Cupcakes. Today, 16th September 2012.
Coil Spring.
So you're coming backwards and forwards to San Francisco and to the US quite a lot at the moment. And so you're living in a hotel room. do you ever get the chance to watch American TV? And do you have any favourites at the moment?
Yeah, so actually, strangely, I watch more American TV at home. I'm a huge American TV fan.
Okay. Just to stop you, Cassie and I are watching Breaking Bad at the moment. We're a bit into season 3, so don't... So
don't spoil. No, that's fine. I won't spoil Breaking Bad for you. Good. I mean, I suppose the thing I love, I think American TV does really, really well, is because there's a group of writers that you tend to get really smart, smart television. That's not to say that there isn't some real dross out there. Obviously, you know, there is, but. I think the things that I'm watching at the moment, I'm loving The Newsroom. I think that's absolutely. Brilliant.
Now that's had mixed reviews, or at least at first.
Yeah, because doesn't surprise me.
I mean, not because it's like it's Aaron Sorkin, so it was like, well, it's exactly like Aaron Sorkin stuff. Well, of course it is. It is Aaron Sorkin. But I think there was some sort of comments about it being a bit implausible, or the characters seem to be a bit very professional in some ways, and then complete amateurs in others. I'm not sure. I don't know. I only watched a couple, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing, so I can see where that commentary is coming from, really. But I think that because you've got these hugely emotional, completely dysfunctional characters,
right.
who, if you sort of stood up in a normal working environment and basically started sort of screaming at one of your colleagues about who you'd happen to have sort of had a relationship with,
yeah,
and kind of airing all of your personal dirty laundry in public, that would never happen in a real work environment. But I don't think he's realistic writer.
Have you ever worked in an engineering office?
Have you sort of had many relationships with other engineers?
Well, not about relationships necessarily, more about the screaming.
Yeah.
But yes, the newsroom is very popular. I mean, so yeah, what are the big, apart from that, are the big blockbusters in, or do you watch it on Netflix or other things? That's,
yeah,
thing.
So Netflix in the UK is not really
Love Film or whatever.
Yeah, Love Film is more, but they don't tend to do. What I really love when I come over here actually is Hulu, because obviously you can watch the shows, and that's where I usually get my American sort of TV fix.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that you guys have just done a US version of The Inbetweeners, which I'd be interested to see.
Uh-huh. Now, you see, I missed out on the English version of The Inbetweeners.
Yeah,
so,
which you have to watch because you were a teenage boy in England, so you would be able to
watch. I was a teenage boy in England. But when is it set?
It's set now.
My experience of England when I was a teenager is not like current teen experiences.
Yeah.
In my day.
But it's that universal truth of being awkward and constantly thinking about sex.
I wouldn't necessarily.
And that's been from the dark ages.
Well, I was going to say, I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the sole domain of teenagers. I mean,
yeah.
40-year-olds as well.
We're going back to Anna Chomsky again.
Maybe. I wish we could. So The Inbetween is interesting. There's a lot of talk at the moment about cutting the cable and using Hulu and stuff,
mm-hmm,
basically exclusively.
Interesting.
And I would say, I mean, there's a lot of reason to do that. I mean, if you cut cable, you can still get most of the major channels, HBO, mm-hmm, and Stars and all, ABC, AMC and all these things. You get the good stuff. You can get the good stuff on Hulu. You can get the good stuff on Netflix. So why do you need the Today Show?
Yeah. I can see that. And I think, yeah, it's a very interesting argument. I suppose the only thing that really upsets me about American television is the fact now that I think it's very difficult for a show to... It seems to be relatively easy for a show to get a pilot and a first series.
Yeah.
And then you will get into that series and
yes,
they'll obviously decide that the ratings are bad and then they'll kill it.
Yes.
And so in our house we've got we really like this show, we think it's really good and it's really smart, therefore it'll be cut within
pretty much
a season.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that sort of happens all the time. So I think, and that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what you've got there is you've got people essentially not wanting to invest in their time and effort in new shows because,
yeah,
you know, you do, and it gets cut, and you... It's almost like having a relationship, isn't it?
Well, this comes back to the video games thing. It's video games, AAA games especially, very expensive to produce, and they've got lots of content, and the same goes for a TV show. I suppose a TV show is more expensive. And you've got to invest so much into it up front that you really want to keep it going, and people get attached to it and really, want to see it keep going.
Mm.
I mean, just look at the... is it the brown shirts or what are they called? Brown jackets? Like this, the Firefly fans. I'm sorry if I get the name wrong.
Yeah.
Not Mussolini's fascist gags.
Yeah.
I think the brown shirts? Brown trousers? Basically, Firefly fans.
Yes.
After it was taken off the air.
Yes.
They are the fans, and they call themselves this term, which I will dub in later.
In a different voice.
In a different
really
voice.
Funny.
And yeah, that would be not obvious at all.
Professional.
Yeah, well that's what professionalism is my adopted middle name. So anyway, Firefly was cancelled, and there was a big outcry, but not a big enough outcry. And then there was a movie, and everyone loved the movie. And I think, I don't know. And the same goes for Arrested Development. Which I think is back.
Yes, so and I think they're doing that exclusively through Netflix, aren't they?
There you go, you see. So it's like, well, who needs the broadcast networks when you've got these streaming services?
Exactly. And you've got the weight of the fans, mm-hmm, essentially. I mean, the same thing happened with Family Guy,
Yeah.
What was that in now? It's 11th or 12th season, but you know, they cancelled
that. Man's ego has no bounds, does
no,
it?
No, absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, and you've even got the essentially films of him doing the same character.
Yeah, interestingly.
I love Seth MacFarlane, actually. Yeah. So, I mean, it's really interesting, and I think it goes back to our earlier conversation about the creative process, and as a consumer now, and a consumer of content, that we have much more ability to shape what we want to see, and yes, you know, and you vote with your feet, really, and
it's easier to vote with your feet when it's on demand.
Mm, absolutely.
When it's just broadcast and everyone, and then they have to go through Nielsen or guess how many people are watching, they can actually see how many people have clicked and watched to the end. They know straight away, even while it's happening, and they can say, "Ha ha, you didn't get your ratings, you're cancelled."
Yeah.
Or not.
But then, you know, isn't that terrible though for the creative process? Because then you've got these shows that potentially are kind of slow burners, and with that kind of content that is so sort of easily consumable and digestible and forgettable.
Yes.
Then, you know, what do you do for great shows that might never get an airing because it takes 4 or 5 episodes to get a following?
You need
word of mouth. Mad Men would be dead.
That's, well, word of mouth does have a lot to do with it, I think. I mean, I remember Armando Iannucci on some Radio 4 6:30 comedy show said once that he said that, you know, people watch the DVD box sets, and he said that his friends were watching the DVD box set of 24, whereas he was watching the DVD box set of BBC News 24. And he got as far as early September 2001. He was going to give up on it, but his friend said, "No, stick with it. It gets really, it gets really good, really, really amazing."
Yeah, I mean, that's what sort of, I suppose sort of fascinates me, is because you get into a situation where as somebody who's creative, you almost like can't make your own choices.
Yeah.
Because does that mean that we start getting, you know, less risk taking in things like video games and
yes,
movies and, you know, television? And you've got, obviously you've got the people who still do that, like HBO, but
right. But then of course but on demand also means that the forms of distribution are more open.
Yeah.
And that goes for games as well. And you've got the independent games a movement, I don't know. There's so many more independent studios. Of course, and it kind of goes back to the early days of your rubber-keyed 16K Spectrum, where it was bedroom programmers.
And yeah.
Independent game studios, I don't think they're in bedrooms necessarily. They're probably in lofts in SoMa, just a few blocks yeah, from here.
I'm sure they are.
But yeah, so you can get something together, you can throw something together early, get it out to people over the web.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for video and podcasts,
yeah,
and sort of
yeah
things. So at the same time as the distribution methods, well, it democratizes it but also makes it much more susceptible to the capricious market.
Yeah, but I think as well, I mean, that you can turn that to your advantage. I mean, obviously there was the project recently which was completely funded by the people who would then potentially buy the games.
Yes, so, of course.
You know, sort of several, you managed to raise several million pounds in capital to be able to develop this game. But then what happens at the end of that process if you develop the game or the product that actually people are disappointed in, and it wasn't.
Well, then they don't buy your next one. Of course, with these funding models like Kickstarter and so on.
Yeah.
The funding only gets released if you get enough people, and then you're obliged to produce, and then I think there is a... I think the Kickstarter terms and conditions has something about you being able to be burned at the stake if you don't actually produce what you promised. There
yeah,
is some kind of sacrificial clause yeah, in there. Pitchforks are involved.
Pitchforks, definitely. Villagers, pitchforks.
Yeah.
But I think that's the interesting thing, and it goes back to what do you... If you do democratise it, you know, what... Then people have a very clear sense of ownership, and you it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because you're taking that to therefore potentially make a game by the people for the people, but then, you know, what we all know what happened at the end of sort of communism and Animal Farm. So
yeah, And then you end up with the lowest common denominator as well, yeah. just to please the masses. And but again, you know, small stuff, niche products for niche markets. Mm-hmm. Everyone's famous for 15 people, as Warhol didn't say. The spread of choices is still there: the big, the small, the independent, the complex, the expensive. And I think there's more and more media to go around.
Yeah,
that can only be a good thing.
Absolutely.
You're listening to the Coiled Spring.
So that's our show. That's the end of episode 2. Thanks for listening. You're probably wondering where the fabled second guest got to. So am I, frankly. I was waiting at the bus stop for about 3 hours and I don't know what happened. So anyway, never mind. Maybe we'll find one for next time. Got loads of great people lined up. It's just a question of getting them together and sticking a tape recorder on them when they're not looking. Anyway, thanks for listening. Come back again soon, and don't forget to check out the website at coiledspring.org. Bye-bye. The Coiled Spring was created, edited, and presented by Matthew Petty and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. Music is by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. And you can send suggestions, comments, requests, and demands to feedback@coiledspring.org. Thanks for listening.